was a shock to be in such calm when mere days earlier we had squeezed our way through Tokyo, a bright, noisy and overflowing city that was only able to contain so much because it was organised like a game of Tetris.
You're listening to All the Best, a weekly documentary and storytelling show from around Australia. I'm Jess Hamilton, and this week we've got stories about coming face to face with unknown environments that might at first make us feel a little small. Mountains, oceans, and big cities.
Let's go surfing now, everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me.
A little over 2 years ago, I started learning to surf. Surfing always seemed like one of those dreamy things that every beach-loving Aussie should be able to do. But it also kind of looked intimidating and I'd always been a bit scared. Well, 2 years into surfing and I thought by now I'd have it down pat. But in reality, more often than not, I still end up getting smashed and stumbling out of the water totally disheartened. My surfing friends keep telling me that that's all part of the experience.
When you're out in the ocean, it's just you, the waves, dolphins.
Yeah, there are a few slabby little rights out
just
there.
Just took one on the head.
Got so pitted.
Yeah. And this is the other thing that intimidated me about surfing. There's this whole language that I just could not understand. Offshore, onshore, bank, slab, shred, dropping in, all these words were completely new to me. It was a whole different world. So I kind of assumed that everyone who started to learn to surf a little later in life would be the same and be just as scared of a tiny wave as me.
No, really, it's not like a scary or something like that, you know? Yeah. It's like kind of amazing, awesome.
So when I met Moy, another learner surfer, I had a vague idea of how I thought our conversation would go. I thought we'd bond over how challenging surfing was. The first time getting dumped, flipping and nosediving and accidentally surfing backwards.
First a few times I fall down and after that, like for a few seconds, I stand up. It's been amazing. I'm very excited. Oh, I done it. I did.
Actually, he got the hang of it straight away.
I never use any surfboard or a skateboard or something like that.
We're drinking tea in his apartment on Redfern on a sunny winter afternoon. A longboard rests in a nook on the balcony outside, and by the door is a skateboard so small it looks to me like a death trap.
It's tiny.
It's all right. If you be very, like, technically, you can jump in it.
Tiny guy.
Doesn't matter.
Our lives at this point could not have been more different. I'm a fourth generation Australian woman who has always lived in Sydney and spent a lot of time at surf beaches. Moy is an Arabic Iranian man who had never been to a surf beach before.
Before I moved to Australia, I saw the Bondi in the TV, you know, but when I arrived there, it was like something dream. Really, at that place, they show to the TV, I'm be here, you know. But I sometimes like proud of myself. Yeah, I crossing something like facing with so many challenge in the way, and I break all the challenge. You know, I've been stronger than that.
Moy came to try surfing through a program called Surfing Without Borders, run by Settlement Services International and Let's Go Surfing at Bondi Beach. See, Moy came to Australia 4 years ago by boat, seeking asylum. Safe to say, standing on a surfboard and getting the hang of surf lingo was not the biggest challenge that he'd faced.
You know, the big challenge when you be cross the ocean, you know, I came by boat 2013. Every second is like a different situation in the ocean, you know. We're going up and down by the things, by the boat. All the people are getting sick and like we're warm in the boat and very little space and a lot of people, you know. And I've been in a situation, it's like that by accident. I didn't choose that situation, but it's happened. I couldn't do nothing, you know? That's a big challenge, but I'm here. I'm very happy. Yeah. My best time of life.
Yeah?
Yeah.
In Australia?
I'm Aussie now.
What makes someone Aussie?
When you be like move country to country, for example, I'm Iranian, I'm Arabic Iranian, you know, and a lot facing with like something like racism in my country. Because of an Arabic Iranian, I couldn't do nothing, you know? Why like that, you know? But in here, like everything possible for me. That is, I feel, be like more Aussie, you know, to Iranian. That's right, I born there. And here, like I living my life like how the Aussie people living. I living my life the same level, nothing different. No one like told me here you are like migrant Australia, you are not Australian or something like that. We be human. Maybe you living somewhere different places, you inherit different language. That is not big point or big deal. You be human.
I get the impression that Moy is someone who would give just about anything a crack. He tells me excitedly about becoming an Aussie and learning to surf, learning a new language and learning to dance.
In the beginning, when I start living in Melbourne immigration, they made a kind of a class about dancing class. I said, oh yeah, kind of surfing or like a dancing class or something like that. We don't have in my community, in my country. And when we moved to Australia, I kind of like open life. Like when I get to Australia by a first few weeks and they start dancing with a girl, I never like we had to dance with a girl. I said, oh my god. And I said, oh Moy, it's like here in Australia, no one cares, open your mind. And they start dancing, it's easy, you know, take it easy. It's not like that kind of country someone like me judge about you who you are or something like that. And I throw all that bad things in the back.
One of the first clubs where Moy went dancing in Sydney was called Scary Canary, which is like one of those places where you step inside and you could be in a backpacker bar anywhere in the world. He'd dance with people from everywhere and welcome them to Australia.
Hey, how are you? Welcome to Sydney. They said, thank you. I'm the Aussie. I tell them, welcome. Yeah, and they like have a broken language, you know, English. Remind me of myself when I get to Australia, like very broken and everyone pissed off from me, you know. But the people like very nice. Oh, you good talking English, we understand you. I said, so thank you so much, you give me big power.
Moy taught himself English when he arrived in Australia, practicing on an app 5 hours a day. He made friends at conversation groups in libraries and would practice with them. He started driving an Uber alongside his day job, mornings and nights, 7 days a week, and talked to people with all sorts of accents. He laughs while telling me stories of passengers who'd guess his accent, wondering where he's from. Brazilian? Portuguese? Spanish? No, he says. I'm an Aussie.
When they asked me where are you from, I said, I'm from my mum. You know? So, oh my god.
His laugh is infectious. He tells me stories of repeat customers who remember him and refuse to get out of his car after their ride.
I put the music, they dance to him. They stop me. You know, I told them, hey guys, let's talk more dancing. And I said that.
Passers-by and staff from nearby restaurants start to join in, and soon everyone is dancing and laughing on the street.
And I get again getting the same time request about the people they was watching me from outside. They stopped me. They say, really, we enjoy from outside. Say, you have to be joined us in dancing. Make a trophy.
Moy is exactly the kind of Aussie who I'd want to meet in the surf. I ask him if he'll keep surfing. Of course, he says. Maybe when it's a bit warmer. A huge thanks to Moy for sharing his story with me. Under very different circumstances to Moy, Maddie Stutchbury also moved to a new city and had to find a place for herself in the big smoke. Here she is.
Sometimes I think the city sounds like an ocean. The sound travels from the ground up. It's this hush, a hum, crash and swell, an urban ocean breaking against the shore. I get this constant urge to press my ear down to the ground to listen to the earth breathing. I want to hear the lungs of the city. There are always seagulls in the city. Why do they fly so far from the water? I've just moved from the water, from a seaside town in the country, where the people are always quiet, but nature is so, so loud. Two hours south of Melbourne is a town called San Remo. It's the gateway to Phillip Island. The people are kind, but I grew tired of spending time in the local pub in the main street of town. Phillip Island is known to Melburnians. Nearly everyone I speak to says that they've been there on holidays, school camps, that they've come down to visit an aunt who has a beach house, and that they've definitely been to see the penguins. Speaks so warmly about a place that I did not want to be in. Their holiday retreat was my hometown nightmare. Now I've moved back to Melbourne and I find myself seeing nature everywhere, like I'm trying to construct a natural world out of the bricks and mortar around me, trying to reconstruct the natural world that I have left behind. If you look around, the city sometimes looks alive, like it's an organic being. I notice the light of the sunset, the way it lights the buildings on fire as though they were the sun. Nature reflected on the shining faces of corporations and brutalist buildings. When my train and four others wait in line to approach the platform at Flinders Street, idling, I look out the window into the fading winter light and I see all these other stationary trains. When I look at them, sometimes these idle trains remind me of skyscrapers that have fallen over onto the ground, like a metallic tree that has been felled, reconnecting with the soil from which it came before being swiftly removed and chopped up into 100 small pieces. When I was in the country, I had all this boundless space to expand into. If I opened my bedroom window on a summer night, I could hear the sound of the beach nearby. Outside, the world teemed with life. Birds sang in the trees first thing in the morning, and possums would grunt and scream at night, dreaming of the wider world and all the fun I was missing out on up in the city. To an extent, I would blame my failures and my surroundings. I wasn't the writer I wanted to be because I had moved to a faraway town. I wasn't the friend I ought to be because I lived 2 hours away and none of my friends were willing to drive down the highway to visit me. I wanted to expand out into the entire universe, to reach out with both hands and take my life and destiny under my control. Now I feel like I have folded in on myself. The buildings in the city stare down at me from their vantage point in the sky, and I feel like they are judging me. I so desperately wanted to move back to the city. Now I'm here and I don't feel like I belong anymore. I don't feel afraid. I don't feel sad. I don't feel out of place. I just feel small.
That story was by Maddie Stutchbury with help from supervising producers Beck Fari and Selena Shannon. You're listening to All the Best and stories about feeling small in unfamiliar places. Our next story takes us to the Fuji Five Lakes District in Japan. Elsie didn't expect to be climbing any mountains when she went backpacking through Japan. But somehow she found herself on a steep uphill, battling mud and rock on a hike she felt totally unprepared for.
We are about to start...
Wrong way.
All right, no, we're going the wrong way. Take two. Now, on our way to what we think is the top of Mount Mitsutoge. As you can hear, it's pretty steep already. I'm with my partner as well, who is probably going to be waiting for me the whole time because he's much more fit than I am.
I like the sign that said this is not a passage, turn back.
It turns out it was a passage, sort of. But when we set out for Japan, it was not a passage we had intended to take. My partner and I were backpacking around the country for around 6 weeks. The only mountaineering we'd anticipated was a bus trip to Mount Fuji Base Camp, but when we reached the Five Lake District in the shadow of that famous mountain, all that changed completely. The five lakes that circled the mountain are home to some of the most peaceful communities that we would come across in Japan. From far away, all the mountains that contained our little town looked untouchable, from another world, rising hills of trees and mystery in every direction. We knew we wouldn't be able to resist taking a closer look. So, knowing very little about hiking, we rashly decided to summit the closest mountain, Mount Mitsutoge, which in comparison to Mount Fuji is tiny, but would still mean a full day's hike return. A fact we knew as we set off in the morning, but a reality that didn't really sink in until we were dragging our feet back towards our temporary home.
We're heading up what seems like a massive amount of steps now. I can't actually see the end of it. It just keeps winding around. God, it's steep.
We were unprepared, that much was clear from the first step. In Australia, we would go bushwalking from time to time, which would sometimes turn into small hikes. We would pack lunch and then head back to the car after an hour or two, barely breaking a sweat. But walking in parts of Australia with English signs, an abundance of fellow hikers and a clear path was a completely different experience. At home, we'd always walk through the familiar, but nothing seemed so comforting as we made our way up Mount Mitsutoge. We had leapt before we looked.
We're now semi-lost. We don't really know where we're going, although we're going with the idea that we just keep choosing the upward path and hopefully we'll get there. Our paper map is very undetailed. And both of our phones say that we're walking in the middle of nowhere now. God, it would be so helpful if we could read Japanese.
There's a map down there. Do you want to have a look?
Yeah, it's not too far down.
We had set ourselves a goal. To reach the top. To reach the top and see that extraordinary Japanese landscape we had glimpsed on the ground level, open out below our feet. But as we made our ascent, white mist had begun to steadily creep over the surrounding mountains with such force and pace that we thought maybe there was a fire. There wasn't. But now we knew we were racing the clouds that would ruin any chance of seeing the countryside and Mount Fuji. We knew we might not get to see anything at all. We kept moving.
Back on the trail, although it's become kind of like an obstacle course now. It's more like a creek bed and it's really muddy and slippery.
The terrain shot up and levelled out. The ground went from muddy to crumbling away at our feet. The track constantly constricted and expanded. It was autumn, verging on winter. The trees had changed in colour all around us, filtering through light that then enveloped us in shadow, making us hot, then cold, hot, then cold. The path kept throwing new challenges our way, which most of the time made it seem like it wasn't a path at all. For at least half of the journey, the ground seemed untouched, so much so that we were surprised and celebrated when we saw footprints other than our own.
There's leaves all over the ground of all different colours, and all the trees are turning yellow and orange. There's branches covering the path, which also makes it, oh god, very difficult. Kind of shimmering our way up now, although it's definitely not as steep as before, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, that's obviously the way up because of the stripes.
Yeah.
God knows where this leads.
Trees have changed again. To acorns, I think, because there's acorns all over the ground. Shoes are covered in mud and I am drenched in sweat.
We slipped over constantly. We were tired and the ground was slick, big rocks and roots obstructing our path. But our payment was the landscape. It was a shock to be in such calm when mere days earlier we had squeezed our way through Tokyo, a bright, noisy and overflowing city that was only able to contain so much because it was organised like a game of Tetris. Now there was space to breathe. We didn't have to battle for space to sit when we needed a rest, or keep quiet when we talked in fear of disturbing the well-mannered locals. Instead of pushing our way through crowds, we were pulling our way through trees. No longer in the shadow of high-rises, now we were only craning our necks to see the top of the mountain that we were scaling. It made the constant struggling worth it. We had successfully immersed ourselves in a peaceful part of a country jostling for space.
Blood sugar levels are getting pretty low since breakfast. Why do people hike up mountains? Such a weird concept to go through quite a bit of work just for a view. I guess it's going to be a pretty good view at the top.
Why do people hike mountains? Partly to see views, to tell all their friends, to test themselves. But that's not all. We do it to reach the top. And for us, it was also to seek out a new place in a way we had never really tried before. We explore Australia for the same reason. While we spend so much time in cafes and shops, walking through towns and cities, you never really get a sense of what Australia really is as a country until you strip it all away. Dip your toe in the sea or brush your finger against the ferns. For us, hiking, real hiking, was challenging and new, but it also gave us a way to see a part of Japan that really made it Japan before the anime and tech engulfed the nation. The view, I guess, was just the cherry on top of a very hard to climb mountain.
We've just kind of come to a massive outlook of Mount Fuji and Lake Kawaguchiyo. And it's incredible. It's a little bit cloudy, but it kind of makes it more mysterious, I guess. It's incredible. Of course, it's no Mount Fuji. Definitely a little a long way down from there, but the view's pretty good.
After staring at the ground in front of our feet for so long, trying not to fall over, it was a relief to see open space. The trees on our mountain stretched out for some time before dropping away. The mist that was slowly settling in and making itself comfortable made the mountains surrounding us look like waves overcoming the valley and the lake below. And above it all, Mount Fuji, a peak that scraped the sky running off into the sea of trees below.
At the moment, we're surrounded by clouds. They're just going, they're passing straight through the trees which are all around us. So when you look out in any direction, through the trees or an open view, there's just white. White, white, white. It looks kind of cool, but also very disorientating. And you feel like you're in the sky, which I guess we kind of are now. But still haven't reached our end goal. So still looking for it.
By this point, we had found people again, which in itself was a huge relief. But it also meant that we really must be close this time, despite all the false premonitions throughout the hike. With tired legs, we kept walking, knowing the end must be only metres away.
All right, it's about 9 degrees at the moment, and I'm in shorts and a jumper. Callum smartly wore jeans. We're currently following two ladies to what we think is the summit, because we literally have no idea where we're going. So hopefully this turns out for the best and they're not heading back down. This is actually it though. Oh, it's really pretty. It's a little clearing with some small rocks scattered around. And an almost 360 degree view of just cloud at the moment, but what I'm sure on a clear day is stunning. Yeah, that's it then. We made it. I think we're ready just to go to an onsen when we get down now, which will be an amazing reward, I think, for what's going to be about a 7-hour hike up and back.
Walking back down, the high of having a goal to reach was no longer there. We were cold and tired and ready to crawl into bed. It seemed to take so much longer to reach the end, the real end this time. But by the time we got to the bottom, made our way to the closest onsen, and submerged ourselves in hot, soothing water, a complete feeling of calm and pride had washed over me, of a world explored, legs used, and a mind expanded.
Probably won't be climbing a mountain anytime soon again. Maybe Mount Fuji, but might just take a bus.
That story was made by Elsie Barth with sound design from Ari Gross and Callum Wakeling, and help from supervising producers Beck Fari and Selena Shannon. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon, our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari, our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie, Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager, Tegan Nichols compiles our show, and I'm Jess Hamilton. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you're keen to make a story for All the Best, get in touch via ep@allthebestradio.com. Even if you've never made radio before, we'll give you all the support you need. That's ep@allthebestradio.com. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app.